You could say he's a dreamer today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, a family from India relocated to Mississippi.
10 years ago, my parents left their professional life in India to find a better tomorrow for me.
Things worked out well for mom and dad. They're now teachers with work visas, but his future?
It's actually more uncertain than it would have been back home.
This young man never qualified for DACA, but as we'll hear, his story parallels those of many so-called dreamers. Also, many Italians thought they'd seen the last of Silvio Berlusconi when he resigned in disgrace as prime minister years ago. Well, he's back.
He is definitely a brilliant politician and definitely a survivor.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. This week on the show, as you may know, we've been focused on walls, invisible walls, not Donald Trump's border wall, which, if it ever gets built, will definitely be something you can see. Instead, the world's been bringing you stories of the barriers some immigrants face in entering or staying in the United States, barriers that are not so obvious. It's a series we're calling Walls We Don't See. Today, we have the story of Mayuk Dutta. He's 19 years old, lives in Mississippi. He came to the U.S. from India with his parents, who have H-1B visas. That means Dutta is not eligible for protection under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program. He's got his own visa, called an H-4 visa. But here's the thing, that H-4 visa expires as soon as Dutta turns 21. Mayuk joins us now from his dorm room at Mississippi State University. Mayuk, explain a bit more of what a H-4 visa actually is, a visa you currently have.
So H-4 visa is typically given to those who are dependent on the H-1B, which is a employment-based visa. It's the visa that my parents are on.
Right. So your parents came here legally and you followed them on the H-4 visa.
That is correct. So my mom came here as a high school teacher in 2008, and a year after, my dad and I followed.
What brought your mom to Mississippi in the first place?
She came to the United States through an agency. It was a government state-sponsored agency, and this agency was responsible for bringing in teachers from foreign countries in underdeveloped areas like the Mississippi Delta region. And the school district she teaches in is called Durant Public School. It's a very impoverished, very underdeveloped area. And seeing as they needed teachers, this agency helped the school out by bringing in my mom in 2008.
And she's been teaching in the Durant schools ever since?
Yes, sir. So has my dad.
All right. Okay. So you've been here since fifth grade. Do you recall what it was like for you landing in Mississippi?
Yeah, I have been here since almost 7, 8 years now. And the one question I get asked is, out of all places, why did I choose a small rural town in central Mississippi? And it was just coincidental, but many of my community members didn't understand where I was from, didn't understand my culture, often confused me as an Indian with someone who was from the Middle East, just things like that. But then as time went on, I became more and more assimilated into the society. And slowly today, basically everyone in Kosciuszko knows me and my family.
What's the name of that town?
It's called Kosciuszko, Mississippi.
All right, named for a famous Polish immigrant, but I'm at pains to remember who.
Yeah. It's named after a Polish general who fought in the American Revolutionary War.
Thank you.
Thaddeus Kosciuszko.
Is there a scenario by which you may have to return to India, but your parents may get to stay here?
Absolutely. And I think after I turn 21, my parents continue on in their H-1B visa so long as they continue to work in Durant. But as for me, if, say, I don't get into a graduate program or I don't find a job that is willing to sponsor my H-1B, then, yeah, the only option left is for me to return to India.
Yeah. How does that idea make you feel?
It's shocking to think that, you know, 10 years ago, my parents left their entire, you know, social and professional life in India to find a better tomorrow for me here. And when we come here, it's actually more and more uncertain than it would have been back home. And it seems like this whole 10-year journey to find the American dream would be futile.
You know, I feel like I've heard a lot of DACA advocates who believe that their cause could be helped by a kind of unification of all young visa recipients. Is that world not unified enough, do you think?
I think it could be more. I think living in a small town in central Mississippi, I definitely feel left out just because, as you imagine, in Mississippi, there isn't much talk going on of DACA. But yeah, it becomes more and more relevant as more and more people are affected by it. And if that can be brought into light, then we are definitely bound to see good change.
Do you know how many H4 dreamers like yourself there are currently in the U.S.?
The numbers are kind of hard to figure out, but I think it's somewhere between 100,000, somewhere around 100,000 in the country.
And what are interactions like with other students at Mississippi State when you explain your visa status? And how does that shift people's views on immigration?
People are surprised. Even some of my closest friends, my high school teachers and my best friends from high school, they had no idea. And as you can tell, I don't have an accent and people just assume that I was born here. I don't think that people know, even in Mississippi State, about the fact that I'm in the H-4 visa. Yeah, there's no information about H-4 dreamers anywhere.
Mayuk Datta is an H-4 dreamer. He's been speaking with us from his dorm at Mississippi State University. Thanks very much for telling us about your situation, Mayuk. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
Dutta's story came to us courtesy of reporter Sonia Paul. It's part of our series, Walls We Don't See. Check out more stories from the series at PRI.org. We've got a quick update now to a story you heard yesterday on the show. We spoke with a member of Canadian outdoor retailer Mountain Equipment Co-op. Some co-op members were upset because MEC does business with a U.S. company called Vista Outdoor. Vista owns several firearms manufacturers, including one that makes semi-automatic rifles. MEC never carried Vista's firearms in its stores, but it did carry outdoor gear made by five other brands owned by Vista. And that's why some co-op members were putting pressure on MEC to take all of Vista's products off of its shelves. Well, this morning, MEC responded. The company head said MEC will stop ordering products made by Vista effective immediately. Now, if you listen regularly to The World, you may remember hearing this. It certainly stuck with me. That's the sound of the data about mass shootings here in the U.S. Each piano note is another day with a mass shooting. The louder the note, the more people were killed on that particular day. This data sonification is the work of The World's Sophie Chow, and she joins me now in the studio. So you turn data into a sound form, Sophie, and when you use it to illustrate gun violence in America, the result was so powerful. But what you created as data sonification has now gotten a second life as actual music. Explain what happened.
Basically, after the first data sonification piece aired on The World, a composer, Joshua Clausen, reached out to me by email, and he said he was really inspired by it and wanted to use it to make a choral piece. Last weekend, he reached out to me with a recording of the piece that was performed in Minnesota, and now it's on tour with the Concordia College Choir.
Also powerful in a different way. We've got composer Joshua Clausen with us. And Joshua, I know this is the first time you and Sophie are actually getting a chance to talk about what you created with her data sonification. So I want to make sure the two of you have a chance to chat. But let me ask you first, you and the choir performed your composition this past Saturday. It's called Requiem. How did you introduce it?
Well, it was the first piece in a larger set that had to do with moving from a kind of metaphorical darkness to light. And there's some peace, I think, to it. I hope that it can help people to find some healing and peace, but there's also a part of it that's unresolved. So the last thing that is heard in my piece, like the sopranos match that B natural pitch and just kind of fade out until you hear only that, you know, that same sound of the sonification that started the piece.
And
and then the set went on to some other pieces that also had to do with light and healing.
Joshua, it's Sophie, or I guess I call you Josh. Yeah, sure. And I wanted to ask you a few questions because I'm really excited. Actually, when I got your piece back, I actually sat down and cried because it was very beautiful to listen to. And the first thing I want to ask you is how you heard the data sonification.
I heard it when it aired in November, I think, on the program. And was just amazed by it. It's so direct. Obviously, it's the sound of real facts, you know, of these terrible, stark facts of our world. But it also struck me how human and vulnerable it sounded, the way you put it together. You know, the notes are quiet most of the time, and they're so rapid. And, you know, at the same time as it was cold and, you know, mechanical, it seemed vulnerable and almost like a SOS, you know, like a message that has come to us from a great distance or something.
Can you tell me why you named the piece Requiem?
Sure. The Requiem text, which of course is a traditional Latin text for the dead, there were two pieces of it that attracted me and that I wanted to, you know, to bring out with the music. One, of course, is just a hope for I haven't been personally affected by, you know, these tragedies, but, you know, I feel things deeply and I'm just, my heart goes out to the people that were affected. So one is just to provide some peace for those people. There's a text in the middle. It's the middle of the piece, and I think the Latin, if I can remember it right, is et lux perpetua lucea deis, which means, and let perpetual light shine on them.
Yeah.
So that's the other part, to make sure that these people, these stories are told, that they're not forgotten, that these people are seen.
Yeah. And I just, you know, for me, it was really powerful because as a data journalist, I'm taking these really tragic events and people are reduced to numbers. And then you're trying to make them alive again by a visual or by a sound. But you're always worried it's not human enough. So I don't know. It was very meaningful to me that you made it truly human again.
Well, it absolutely is, though. I wanted to compliment you on that. What you were able to create on its own is really remarkable, and I felt really honored to, you know, to have your permission and to get to work with it musically.
So Joshua, as I said earlier, you performed Requiem in Minneapolis last week, and I know you're planning to tour it. Are there upcoming performances in places where you think it'll be especially poignant?
Yes, it's going to be performed in a half dozen or so states in the Midwest and the South. I know there are some cities on the tour in Oklahoma and some in Texas. And of course, there are some tragic events that come to mind recently and in the past. So yeah, I'm really hopeful that it can, you know, do some good, provide some peace for the people there that hear it.
Minneapolis-based composer Joshua Clausen and the world's Sophie Chow, who was the inspiration for Joshua Clausen's composition, Requiem. Thanks, both of you, very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Save the whales, a slogan that helped launch a movement decades ago, but it's still relevant today. Some whale species are doing well now, but others are definitely not. And there's one that scientists are especially worried about. It's the North Atlantic right whale. There are only 430 of them left, and over the past year, a record 18 have died. Meanwhile, there have been zero births. At this rate, scientists think the species could be extinct within just 6 years. Dr. Charles Stormy Mayo is the director of the Right Whale Ecology Program, the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, Massachusetts, out on Cape Cod. So what's happening here, Dr. Mayo? Why has there been such a drop in the right whale population?
The story is just a simple one of arithmetic. The mortalities that you've just mentioned are going up, and the births, at least so far this year, seem to be way down. And the story in that respect is one that adds to a long-standing concern about the whale's future. If you have fewer births and higher mortalities, extinction is around the corner, and we'll hope it isn't happening, but it looks like a possibility.
Tell us a bit about the right whale. Where does it fit into all the whale species in terms of size, and they're all in the North Atlantic?
Well, no, there are three species of right whales. Here in the North Atlantic, the one that we're talking about, there's a North Pacific right whale that isn't very well understood. And then there is a southern right whale, which lives pretty much around the tips of the continents off of Antarctica. And that one is fairly numerous, although still considered endangered. These are animals of up to perhaps 60 feet in length. They're very broad, very wide animals, a huge layer of blubber, very oil-rich, which is what made them so important in early whaling. And they're plankton feeders. They feed very low in the ecosystem, which works great if you have plenty of plankton. But if the system is changing, the ocean is in a change, there's a great concern that these whales may not find the food they once had in large numbers.
Well, a few years ago, I understand, the right whale population, at least the population we're talking about, wasn't in such bad shape. What did change?
Well, some of it we know and some of it we don't know. It is not clear exactly why the reproductive rate of this population has been low and, in fact, is getting even lower. And the other part of it is that the mortality is going up because the whales are, especially this year, entering areas that are not well protected. And so they're being struck by ships and they're getting entangled in fishing gear.
Yeah, what happens when whales get tangled in those lines, and how big a problem is that?
Well, that is one of the great problems, maybe the main cause of mortality. The animals simply run into ropes and wrap themselves up in those ropes. Many of them actually get themselves out, but if the ropes are very heavy and the tangle is very bad, the whale may drag heavy gear, it's usually anchored gear, and they may drag that for up to many months, in some cases years.
What is it like to help free a whale that's gotten stuck? Because I know you've been part of many efforts to disentangle whales.
Well, you can imagine you're dealing with an animal of such power in its environment as we work from small boats. I recall too many of them, and many of them have been very intense. The ones I recall are the ones we failed on, right whales that were so severely entangled, animals that refused to let us get near them, one in particular up in Canadian waters, was an animal we went back to, I think, on four different occasions. Females are obviously very important to maintaining the population, and she was so severely wrapped up, we could not cut the last line, which was wrapped around her body and cutting into her. And eventually, after many efforts, she was last seen, a very sick animal off of New Jersey, barely able to swim. And shortly after, the telemetry, the satellite tag we had on her, dropped from sight, and she dropped into the deep ocean.
And that is so tragic.
That one was a very difficult one, and one that I remember because we didn't succeed. I think I remember those and some harrowing efforts better than I do even the ones we succeeded on. However, I think it's important to say that disentanglement is probably not the answer. We must find a way of helping the fishermen to keep these whales out of the tangles that they get in.
I know fishing line technology, like fishing line, has actually gotten stronger and better over the years. That must play into all of this in some way.
My family has been a fishing family here on Cape Cod since the 1600s, and they would in those days have greatly appreciated these lines that don't rot and that are very strong. But of course, if an animal gets tangled in it, then it will not rot off of the animal as they once did. I think the answer, clearly, for many of us, is developing technology that allows the fishermen to have fixed gear fishing for crabs and lobsters and the like, but do so without ropes coming to the surface. if we can go ropeless, we will have the answer to at least this part of the story of mortality in right whales.
How much a role is climate change playing in the dropping population of right whales?
I wish we could know. As you know, climate change is here, and here particularly in the Gulf of Maine and Cape Cod Bay where we're working, and we know that it's having a big impact. But the problem we have is that trying to separate the natural variability in the ecosystem from the variability added by climate change is not an easy task. My sense is that some of the dramatic changes in where whales are going, and therefore where they're being exposed to risk in order to find their food, is probably influenced by climate change.
So you said your family's been in the fishing business on Cape Cod since the 1600s. So like Mayo Beach, that's your family?
Yes, right. That's part of my family, yeah.
So you basically stayed in the family business, a slight adjustment.
Yeah, you might say I'm the first of our family that did not make its living fishing. In large part, my family was mackerel fishermen, but they occasionally would bring a harpoon along and would harpoon right whales, of all things.
Wow.
And a few of the ancestors of the whales I'm looking at are here because my ancestors weren't a good shot, I guess.
Dr. Charles Stormy Mayo, director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Marco. I appreciate a chance to talk about this.
We've got just enough time for a quick story before the break. And for this one, you need to put your cell phone down. Seriously.
I think there's a growing concern, anecdotally, among psychiatrists and health professionals that there's a definite link between the amount of time you spend on your device and growing rates of anxiety and mental health depression. There is a mounting body of evidence suggesting that we really do need to cut the time that we spend on our devices.
That's my BBC colleague Jane Wakefield. She's been reporting on a new app for your phone designed to reward you for staying off your phone.
It's basically been developed by three students who met at the Copenhagen Business School, and they really were worried about this distraction, device distraction. So they came up with this idea that students could accumulate points and then spend them on things. So on this particular app, you have you accumulate 10 points for every 20 minutes that you don't touch your phone. And to put that in some sort of context, 300 points would earn you 2 free cups of coffee. So that equates to about 10 hours off of your phone. So you have to work at it.
The app's currently available in a number of Scandinavian countries. It's also rolling out soon to students at British universities. Sorry, but we don't know when it might be made available here in the U.S. But you can still put your phone down in the meantime. Our reward, another 30 minutes of the world. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, why the government of Equatorial Guinea has jailed a cartoonist for the past 6 months.
It was clear from the very moment that Ramon was being targeted for using his art to criticize the excesses of a government that has been in power longer than any other government that we can point at.
That story is still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Things are looking kind of surreal in Italy these days, and I could be talking about the snow that fell on Rome this week. But more surreal are the elections coming up on Sunday and a familiar name in the race. Yep, Silvio Berlusconi, the 81-year-old politician whose career went down in flames several years ago. He had 3 stretches as prime minister, was at one point wildly popular, then got embroiled in sex scandals and faced charges he paid for sex with an underage woman. Berlusconi was forced out as leader in 2011 amid a debt crisis, and because of a tax fraud conviction, he can't run for office again until next year. And yet right now, he's a major player in Sunday's election. Angela Giuffrida is going to help us understand what's going on. She's based in Rome, where she writes for The Guardian. So what's the skinny here, Angela? What are the parties duking it out in this election? And where does Berlusconi fit into all of this?
Well, he's been described as a kind of alchemist. If we take our minds back to a few months ago at regional elections in Sicily in November, he forged together a coalition of his Forza Italia party and 2 far-right parties, which led to a surprise victory. And the Sicily vote was very much seen as a litmus test to what could happen nationally. So the same coalition got together for the national vote. And really, he's seen, you know, as a kind of kingmaker, firstly in bringing together that coalition. They've managed to kind of draw on each other's different advantages across the country in order to shore up support.
So he was kind of a kingmaker in Sicily, but can Berlusconi kind of win Italians and the rest of the country? I mean, is he doing that? And how did that comeback happen?
Well, when Berlusconi, you know, when everyone thought he was gone in 2013, when he was ejected from Parliament due to the tax fraud conviction, which then obviously meant that he was banned from running for office for another 6 years. At that stage, his party, you know, support for the party dwindled quite a lot. But in recent months, especially since the Sicily vote, it has gained more and more traction, and a large part of his support comes from the older generation, people that have voted for him in the 2013 election as well. And also because of disillusionment with the centre-left party.
You know, it's really interesting. We spoke 4 years ago with journalist Gianni Riotta in Italy on the first day of Silvio Berlusconi's community service at a home for Alzheimer's patients in Milan. That was in 2014. And I asked Gianni then if that was truly the end of Berlusconi's career. Let's just hear his answer.
Berlusconi is a survivor and Berlusconi is a fighter. As a political leader, he's doomed, he's finished, but he still has a grip on, let's say, 1 out of 5 Italian voters.
So, Angela, two things there. Gianni said his political career is doomed. Apparently it isn't. Would you say that Berlusconi still has sway over 1 in 5 Italian voters?
He is definitely a brilliant politician. And definitely a survivor. And you see a lot of the parties around him. So if you look at his coalition parties, they're actually very dependent on him to even have the chance of entering government.
What about the anti-immigration talk from Forza Italia and Berlusconi? How are Italians responding to that?
Well, at the beginning, when the coalition was first formed, Berlusconi was seen as the person who could perhaps keep his far-right anti-migrant partners in check. But more recently, as immigration has been at the forefront of the campaign, he's kind of fanned the flames a little when Berlusconi pledged to deport 600,000 illegal migrants. That really changed the tone of the debate, and the debate became much more toxic and much more divisive.
Yeah, so anti-immigration rhetoric, he's a billionaire, there are sex scandals around him, not to mention those bunga bunga parties and a TV personality. It does sound a bit like someone we know here in the States. I got to say, when Trump first announced his intention to run for president, a lot of people turned to Italy to wonder how things worked out under Berlusconi as a kind of acid test. Is it fair, though, to compare Berlusconi to Trump?
I think in some ways, in that they give the impression that they're self-made and they've made a lot of money. But in other ways, I mean, I think Berlusconi plays a more wiser, longer-term game because he wants to stay in power. He wants to be at the center of politics.
Angela Giuffrida writes for The Guardian in Rome. Thanks for being with us, Angela.
Thank you.
So as you just heard, Italians will be thinking about immigration when they go to the polls on Sunday. Recent polls show rising anti-immigrant sentiment in Italy, and some politicians have been exploiting those fears, especially in the far-right strongholds of northern Italy. That harder line is now beginning to affect even places that have traditionally been welcoming to outsiders. Caterina Fernandez-Martins reports from the Italian town of Schio.
For over a decade, Cindy has felt at home in Schio, a small town in northeast Italy that somehow reminds him of his city, Zaho, in northern Iraq.
La vita a Schio mi piace perché è più o meno uguale mia città. E tutti due lati.
I like my life in Schio because it's surrounded by mountains, just like my hometown. Mountains are a part of my life.
Cindy, who doesn't feel comfortable giving his full name, was lucky to land here in Schio. The town has welcomed immigrants for decades and has a reputation of looking after its workers. That tradition dates back to the 19th century, when the Italian industrialist Alessandro Rossi built schools, nurseries, and housing for his workers here.
Tu puoi mettere anche così?
Sì.
Cucire così, tu in modo che tu vedi. Praticamente è fatta così.
Cindy makes a living sewing in a clothing shop not far from the old workers' quarter. The day I visit, is training a colleague. He makes minimalist dresses and purses in high-quality Italian fabrics. The wages allow him to support his wife and three children.
Dopo ho studiato elettronica tecnica di sistemare cellulari computer sia in Turchia sia in Siria.
I studied computer electronics and cell phone systems in Turkey and in Syria. Here, I'm making bags and sewing. It's very easy to make a bag. I have no difficulties doing it.
Cindy's doing well, but he can feel attitudes toward immigrants like him hardening, especially ahead of the election.
Io vedo che reazioni anche parole sono un po' cambiate. Trattano un pochino.
I've noticed that reactions and words are changing. We're treated a bit worse now.
Even here, in Schio. 4 years ago, the town elected a far-right mayor who wants a crackdown on immigration. I meet him in his office, a few steps away from the shop where Cindy works. He is among those who refuse to condemn the suspect in the shooting of 6 African immigrants in the town of Macerata in early February.
L'atto, diciamo, di esasperazione di questa persona arriva dopo una serie di atti che si sono.
The exasperated act of that person happened after a series of events. If we don't control immigration, we can't control the increase in criminality.
In the run-up to Sunday's election, Orsi and others have repeatedly blamed migrants for a rise in crime. But the facts don't bear that out. And in Schio, one group of citizens recently launched a petition to shut down the town's asylum program. But in the end, they didn't succeed.
Ciao! Sola!
The mood is different at Annalisa Brissan's house. She's a teacher who tutors immigrants' kids long after the school day is over. She rejects the idea that immigration is out of control and has faith that her town will stay positive.
Allora, Schio. Ah, è una bella esperienza perché l'integrazione è venuta in maniera.
Schio is a good experience in terms of integration because immigration happened smoothly. We never had bad experiences. We never had ghettos for non-Italians either, and we never had problems that happen when people are separated.
Perché il papà non dà più un telefono a mio fratello.
The day I visit Annalisa at home, I find her comforting a Chinese kid whose father took away his cell phone because he didn't do well enough in Italian class. She's also helping a Moroccan teenager with a Pythagorean theorem. She tells me this student's family was helped by an Italian lady who became his almost grandmother. According to Annalisa, this web of solidarity among neighbors has helped integrate foreigners into the life of the town. For a long time, a good economy helped too, she says. But when the financial crisis of 2008 happened, unemployment hit everybody in the town. And while many here tell me the new right-wing mayor doesn't speak for them, immigrant advocates do acknowledge attitudes are hardening. Recently, they changed their strategy. An NGO called Mondo nella Città, the world in the city, is encouraging refugees and migrants to tell their stories. And the store Cindy works for opened up a showroom on a main street so that townspeople could see immigrants working with dignity. People like Annalisa Bressan are confident that Schio will remain a haven for refugees and migrants, working hand in hand with locals.
Quello che muove I rapporti è alto, altro, da un movimento politico.
What drives the relationships is something other than a political movement. What drives a society forward are the ideas in people's minds. The minds of the people in Schio are focused on solidarity and neighborhood.
Back in his workshop, Cindy is listening to news about the bombing of a Kurdish-controlled city in Syria as he sews 2 pieces of blue fabric for a purse. He's not so sure things will remain the same.
If they're targeting migrants in Macerata, I'm afraid, to be honest. I mean, I left my country for that same reason.
Cindy tells me he's happy to talk in schools and to display his work in the new showroom. He's convinced those efforts help curb racism. But he wishes migrants and refugees had a vote.
Allora, lezioni io non faccio parte. Perché anche questo è un grosso problema anche per noi.
I am not a part of elections, and that's a big problem for migrants. I can only hope Italians choose someone who is good for all of Italy. When Italy works for Italians, it works for me as well. If Italy doesn't work for Italians, it doesn't work for me either.
For the World, Caterina Fernandes-Martins, Schio, Italy.
We speak a lot of languages here in our newsroom. Makes sense, right, for a show called The World. So naturally, this next segment from our friends over at the BBC Fifth Floor podcast struck a chord with us. The Fifth Floor at the BBC in London is where many of the different language services, other than English, are located. And on this week's podcast, some of the journalists there share their favorite expressions that defy translation. First up, João Felete of BBC Brazil on that most melancholy and elusive of Portuguese expressions, saudade.
We say that someone is feeling saudade when this person is missing something, a person or a place. When Portuguese sailors traveled around the world many centuries ago, they felt saudade. They missed their land. What I like about the idea of saudade is that it blurs the separation between past and present, because it refers to something that has already happened, or someone who has died, something that you used to eat a lot when you were a child, or a vacation a long time ago. So it's something in the past. But when those memories come to you and provoke saudade, that means that they're very much alive inside you. And so the past becomes very present for you. And it's very hard to translate this concept, because saudade is a feeling, and it's a very complex one. It could be a good thing, having saudade, and it could be a bad thing. And it could be both, actually.
I'm Jinxi Chao, senior producer, Chinese Service. There is a one word they called guanxi. It indicates a lot of things in different contexts. So when you go to China, somebody will suggest, especially the Chinese or your Chinese friend will suggest, you should know guanxi before you go to China. It's a very important word. It means a lot of things. For example, if a child wants to go to university, your relatives will ask you, have you got a guanxi? That means, have you got the back door? Do you know some teachers or scholars who can help your child to go to university? Or sometimes means that love affair. And the business partnership or your suppliers or the relationship between different companies, all these things. But the cultural phenomenon in China, in a society where there are, you know, lack of regulations, you have to rely on guanxi, the so-called relationship.
I am Enisyen Erdem from BBC Turkish Service. In Turkish, we have a saying which is untranslatable to other languages. It's kolay gelsin. It's basically a well wish for people who are doing very hard job. Like if you see someone carrying a very heavy load, you say kolay gelsin. If you see someone working really hard at their desk, you say kolay gelsin. It's sort of saying, may it be very simple and easy for you.
My BBC colleague, Enis Senerdum, from the Fifth Floor podcast, ending that story about expressions in different languages that defy translation. We don't hear a lot of news from Equatorial Guinea. Part of it is an island, part of it's tucked into a corner of mainland West Africa. It gets forgotten, probably to the relief of its rulers over the years. But today we're talking about it because something important has happened there. You may remember last year we reported on the case of Ramon Esono Ebale, a political cartoonist from Equatorial Guinea. He'd lived outside the country for several years, but had gone back to Equatorial Guinea to renew his passport. That was 6 months ago, and that's when things went bad. While he was there, he was jailed on charges of money laundering, but the real reason, according to many people, was his cartoons. They are sharply critical of Equatorial Guinea's dictator, Teodoro Obiang, who came to power in a coup in 1979. Then this past Tuesday, all charges against Esono Ebale were dropped, and the cartoonist is set to be released soon. Tutu Alicante is a friend of Ramon Esono Ebale's. He's also executive director of EG Justice, a human rights group in Equatorial Guinea, which campaigned on behalf of Ramon Esono Ebale. Tutu Alicante, thanks for being with us. What was your reaction when you heard the charges against Essono Ebale had been dropped?
From the beginning, from the time Ramon was detained, you know, we all know that the charges brought against him were completely made up. So it was a relief. It was a relief. But despite this positive outcome, as you noted at the introduction, Ramon is still in prison. Ramon has not been released yet, right? We're still waiting for the sentencing hearing, which we're hoping might take place tomorrow and allow Ramon to join his family this weekend. But we are relieved. We are relieved to see that, you know, at least in this case, some sense of justice, you know, can be claimed here. However, many people remain in prisons in Equatorial Guinea who have not committed any crime.
But despite many other political prisoners still in jail in Equatorial Guinea, and despite the fact that Essono Ebale also has not been released yet, you still see this as an important decision by the court there.
That is because it was clear from the very moment that Ramon was being targeted for speaking out, for using his art and using his blog to criticize the excesses of a government that has been in power longer than any other government that we can point at. Right. And to realize that, you know, in this type of case, with sufficient pressure from the international community, from artists, from activists, we can get Ramon to rejoin his family. For me, that is a success, because there are hundreds of people in Equatorial Guinea who have spent years and years and will continue to languish in jail until President Obiang decides. And I should remind your audience here that when we talk about Equatorial Guinea, we're talking about a government that now sits on the UN Security Council, right? So this is not a government, or this is not a country that is completely unknown to the international community. You know, this is a country that has also chaired the African Union and held important international conferences in the country. Yet he gets away with torturing people, with disappearing people, with extrajudicial killings that tend to go unreported, and certainly with complete lack of accountability in the part of the Equatorial Guinean government.
So you see this as a rare moment in Equatorial Guinea where the state admits essentially it made a mistake.
That is correct. Ramon, in fact, on Tuesday, you know, the reason Ramon is able to walk and go home, you know, because the police officer, the accusing witness, the chief witness for the prosecution here, recanted his story.
So Equatorial Guinea is this country that's famously oil rich but desperately poor. And President Obiang, of course, sits on a lot of those riches. It's thought that President Obiang was especially offended by Essono Ebale's graphic novel, Obi's Nightmare, which is basically about a fantasy where President Obiang wakes up one day and is living like an average citizen in Equatorial Guinea. What exactly did the graphic novel show? Why was it so offensive?
The graphic novel shows the corruption, the crime, the excesses of this government that's been in place for now 39 years. And that is something that President Obiang will not going to admit. It shows Obiang, Obiang's wife and family members depicted in several ways. Because remember, Ramon's idea behind this novel was to have citizens laugh, right? Laugh and lose that fear of Obiang, who many people see as God inside the country. And that type of poking fun at someone that sees himself as all-powerful is a type of criticism or the type of freedom of expression that Equatorial Guinea, or President Obiang in this case, does not permit.
Can the citizens of Equatorial Guinea see his work?
Yes, they have. We have to say, because Ramon was outside the country and sharing all that work on the internet, and internet penetrability in Equatorial Guinea is very low. In fact, as we speak, Facebook, Twitter, and other social media sites are completely banned inside Equatorial Guinea. However, people were able to find creative ways, going to cyber cafes or going to their offices at oil companies and government offices, to download the blogs and the images that Ramon was creating so they could share it otherwise.
Tutu, are you confident that Essono Ebale will be walking freely next week?
Judging from what happened on Tuesday, I think the judicial authorities have no choice but to acquit him of all charges and let him go free. However, the experience of almost 40 years of dictatorship in my country tells me we cannot be confident, we cannot celebrate until Ramon is in fact at home with his family. So while Ramon remains in the country, he remains in a huge prison, which is Equatorial Guinea.
Tutu Alicante, the founder and head of EG Justice, a human rights group devoted to political and legal reform in Equatorial Guinea. Thanks very much for being with us, Tutu.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
A cartoonist, the target of the regime in Equatorial Guinea. In Egypt right now, singers, especially women singers, are also finding joking around can result in jail time. That's what a major Egyptian pop star found out this week. We'll bring you her story tomorrow. You'll hear about Shireen Abdelwahab, who was sentenced to 6 months in prison after kidding with concert goers about this song.
The song is called Have You Drunk From the Nile? And Shireen joked, well, you know, you're better off not drinking from the Nile because you're going to get bilharzia, which is a waterborne disease that has long plagued Egypt. So it was a joke.
A joke the Egyptian regime did not think was funny. So not only is it risky to drink from the Nile, apparently, it's also risky to poke fun at it. More on that tomorrow here on The World. And that's where we leave it today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. See y'all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.